Hi, this is Lynn Thompson with the On Purpose podcast, and it's October 2020. One of my favorite guests over many years of doing the show of Living on Purpose, and now more recently the On Purpose podcast, is a guest I had in the spring of 2006, and that's Dan Millman. During those early days of the radio show, I would regularly Google search my name and the name of the show to see what would show up. And this one time in 2006, I found that Dan Millman, who I knew as a great author of No Ordinary Moments and Way of the Peaceful Warrior, he had written a book called Living on Purpose, the same name as my radio show, now podcast still on women's radio. So it was a natural to welcome him to be my guest on the show. So this interview was live on CHLY in Nanaimo. I've just refreshed it a bit with weaving music through Audio Hero by Black Fedora. We cover a lot of great topics that are timeless. So it's as relevant today as it was 14 years ago. Find out more on peacefulwarrior.com. Okay, enjoy and feel free to be in touch. The On Purpose Podcast at gmail.com.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Lynn.
How are you?
Good. Glad to be with you today.
That's great. I'm so glad you could join us. Welcome to Living on Purpose.
Thank you. And given the title of my recent book, it is almost surreal to hear you saying, "Welcome to Living on Purpose." I was a young gymnast at the University of California, Berkeley, years ago, and I found my calling for teaching when I realized no matter how much I improved myself, only one person benefited. But if I could somehow influence other people, that made my life more meaningful. I began to teach what I knew, which was gymnastics. And over time, especially after meeting an old man in a gas station I called Socrates, because he reminded me of the old Greek sage, and other adventures that followed, my interests expanded from the athletic arena, where I'd had some success, I was a world champion and so on, to a larger arena of life. So it wasn't so much about developing talent for sport, but talent for living. And that led to, making this story very short, travels around the world and studies with various mentors as well over the years, and finally written 12 books. And as you know, The Way of the Peaceful Warrior is now coming out as a movie. Peaceful Warrior with Nick Nolte.
This is an unusual kind of film. I mean, it's not your regular Hollywood sex violence kind of film. This is a more spiritual, life-oriented kind of film. Do you think that this fits into context with what people are wanting to see today?
No sex? Oh, I'm disappointed. No, actually...
There is a little bit, isn't
actually,
there?
Actually, yeah, the love life of the character in the film, Dan, probably was a bit more active than mine was in college. I enjoyed it vicariously.
I'm sure
actually,
you did.
Actually, it is a PG-13 film, so my grandkids, my grandson saw it, you know, and they had no problem at all with the content.
Sure.
Yes, you're right. It is open. It's very wholesome and nourishing and open to many people. And the film is unusual in that it may be one of the first successful mainstream examples of, dare I say it, personal growth cinema. The film is kind of a litmus test. It identifies those who value personal growth material and those who disdain it. The first group love the movie, and audiences are loving it. Some critics are not, especially the cynical ones. But those who are humble enough to know we're all growing and learning, and who do occasionally look at books on how to improve themselves, they're just so enthusiastic about the film. And the word of mouth is very good, and I think it's going to soon be shown around the U.S. and Canada.
Let's review some of the concepts that show up in the movie and leave the movie itself for viewers to see as freshly as they can as far as, you know, the content goes.
Sure.
One of the things that you talk about with Socrates is the idea of house rules.
Well, that's an excellent segue. One of my more recent books is called Living on Purpose, same as your show. And I was sitting up on the roof of my house. I remember trying to figure out a title. And I was just daydreaming, and I was talking to myself going, you know, so many people sort of live on accident, going from one accident to the next. And I said, no, this book is not about living by accident. It's about, and I went, yes, there's the title, Living on Purpose. So I guess great minds think alike. It's based upon 24, quote-unquote, house rules. The story of Peaceful Warrior in the book, I would ask Socrates, well, what about this or what about that? And in answer to many of my questions, he would just shrug and go, well, it's the house rules. That often refers to the rules of a particular house or a gambling house. But, of course, he's referring to the cosmic house rules, the universal ones, universal laws, principles that are timeless, that are universal, that apply. We can count on them. This idea of house rules or spiritual universal laws came to me when I was a young man. I was pretty disoriented, and I wanted to understand, what are the rules here? How does life work? So I began to collect quotations. It's been a hobby for probably 30 years now, at least. One quotation would say one thing, and another would seem to contradict it. I came across one that said, a penny saved is a penny earned. Now, that made sense. It seemed to be valid. But then I came across another one that said, nothing ventured, nothing gained. And another quotation was, birds of a feather flock together. And I went, well, that seems to be true. Oh, but opposites attract. And it goes on and on. And then I came across a saying that we've all heard. It's a cliche by today. It's a chain breaks at its weakest link. And I went, yeah, but there was no buts. I couldn't find an exception. You break 1,000 chains, 10,000, every single one is going to break at its weakest link. And it's not just chains. It applies to us, too. Everything I've ever seen in the universe, I know because I've checked.
Well, and one of your house rules here that I've noted is, for every strength, there is a weakness, and for every weakness, a strength.
Yeah.
So that kind of links in, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. And there are 24 of these, such as Earth is a school and daily life is our classroom. Mm-hmm. We can control our efforts, but not the outcomes. These kind of axioms, what they do is they offer us reminders of what we already know but might have forgotten. All of us know these things on a deeper level, but often reminders can be helpful.
Oh, yeah.
If I might indulge myself, because I think your listeners might enjoy it, a brief story from Living on Purpose about a young boy named David Henry, which illustrates the last house rule you mentioned called play to your strengths. This was a 10-year-old boy, and he had lost his left arm in an auto accident. Mm. But despite his disability, he decided to study judo with an old Japanese judo master, or sensei, which means teacher. David progressed well, but he couldn't understand why, after 3 months of training, his teacher had taught him only a single judo move. His sensei explained, this is the only move I'm going to teach you, and the only one you'll ever need to know. Several months later, he attended his first tournament, and he deftly used the one move to win the first three matches, to his surprise. Amazed, he found himself in the finals, but this time he was clearly outmatched. His opponent was not only larger and stronger, but also more experienced. But when his opponent made a critical mistake, David used his one move to pin the other boy and win the tournament. Later, his teacher explained, you won for two reasons. First, you've nearly mastered one of the most difficult throws in all of judo. Second, the only known defense for that move is for your opponent to grab your left arm. So that's an example of how his weakness had become his strength. Many of us don't appreciate that in our own lives, how sometimes a weakness can become a strength, but the point is to play to our strengths. So many of us try to figure out our life, and we're ignoring what's in front of us, what we're good at, what we love to do, finding that gift, and then getting someone to pay us for it.
The real battles, as you've said in your book, we face inside of ourselves.
Mark Twain once said, I've had many troubles in my life, most of which never happened. And yes, that's this subjective struggle we create in our lives. Sometimes birds are singing outside, a beautiful sky, trees around us, and meanwhile we're going through all kinds of hells in our own mind. And nothing around us is justifying that. We're stuck in something we said or shouldn't have said and then the past, or we're concerned with something that we anticipate is going to happen and we're anxious about the future, instead of settling into this moment, settling into what is more real for us rather than this internal battle. But yes, we all face battles with self-doubt, insecurity, and various kinds of fears, and that's why each of us is a peaceful warrior in training.
What is to be done about this mind that keeps pulling us out of the now and out of the here?
I have a rather radical approach, which is quite different from what is normally prescribed in the world today in spiritual literature and self-help literature. Most of us, and perhaps many people listening to this program, have the presumption, as if it is truth with a capital T, that enlightenment or personal and spiritual growth involves fixing our insides. We just go, well, yeah, don't you need a quiet mind and positive thoughts and have the right feelings like courage and compassion and gratitude? Yeah, if you can only generate those feelings and thoughts, boy, then your life's going to go great.
Piece of cake.
Yeah, piece of cake. Well, I've found that I have less control. Maybe somebody else has more control, but I haven't noticed too many people who can, by their will themselves just to feel happy or to feel anything else. Feelings are like the weather. They come and go. They pass. And that's one of the house rules in Living on Purpose, too. The emotions all pass unless we re-stimulate them. They come and they go, just like a river. The same thing with thoughts. I don't have a spam filter in my head. I can't stop a thought from happening. In fact, if someone wants to become obsessed, best way they can do it is just try not to think about something all day. Rather than focus on trying to fix my mind and have it quiet and all positive and my emotions, I'm focusing in these days on what I do moment to moment. And again, many people, that's behavioral psychology, or they'll put it in the cubbyholes they kind of understand, or fake it till you make it, which is, there's a lot to say for that. I often ask people, would you rather live with someone who was enlightened but behaved really crazy, or someone who was kind of crazy but behaved in an enlightened way? It's an interesting thing to contemplate. It's a rhetorical question, of course.
If you knew you only had a short time to live, what would your priorities be?
Well, that's a good one to contemplate. The point that Socrates made was we all only have a short time.
Exactly, yeah.
And two other good questions I find. One would be, what do you want to look back on? You know, when we're making a decision, should I do this or shouldn't I do this? Is it a good idea or not? What choice will I make? Is to say, okay, in 10 years from now, what do you want to look back on? What choice you made? What would you want to tell your children and grandchildren? This is a choice I made. And a third question I think is very useful is, what would I do if I had no fear? To ask yourself that. You can say, well, yep, you know, I do have fear. Well, fine. But if you had no fear, what would you do? Those three questions I think can help remind us and kind of set us back on a path of light, kind of our higher self, what it might do.
Moderation, not actually being something to strive for, which I think is kind of a surprise. I think many people think, oh, moderation's the key. But I really like what I just read, which is, when you sit, sit. When you stand, stand. But whatever you do, don't wobble. And once you make your choice, do it with all your spirit.
Yes, even if you make a mistake, you can look back and say, yes, but I did it with passion. You know, instead of this milquetoast tiptoeing through life till we die, you know.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. We all can appreciate the golden mean, all the sages of ancient China taught the middle way and moderation in all things, including moderation. You know, when Socrates stood up and railed against moderation, he was just doing a kind of one of his riffs, basically. He wasn't seriously saying one's life should be a series of nothing but extremes. What he was talking about is many people mistake moderation for a lukewarm approach to life. They never take a good hot shower. They never take a stimulating cold shower. It's always got to be just the right temperature.
Just right.
We get into this comfort zone, and so they call that moderation. It's hardly living. There are times we want to explore the extremes, but we want to balance them out as well, of course. Otherwise, we can burn ourselves out. So he was just talking about living in a passionate way and exploring the whole of life, but at the same time, of course, overall, to live in a sense of balance.
Rather than doing something, you meditate in action. What exactly is that, Dan?
First of all, let me tell you a brief story. When
okay.
I was coaching at Stanford University, the gymnastics team, way back, I'd gotten a reputation as sort of being a weirdo. And the coaching community was extremely conservative at that time. I mean, even the fact that I grew a beard made me very strange, because coaches just didn't have beards in those days. Athletes, forget about it. They had heard rumors that I was teaching my athletes to meditate before competition. And I said to the coach, of course not. I said, my team doesn't meditate before competition. They meditate during competition. And the point I was making is, what is meditation? What is it except insight, observing oneself, and letting go, and just letting things happen as they do, without reaction, without resistance? This is a meditative stance. You sit, you don't lean forward into the future or backward into the past. It's balanced. So, now, anybody who's studied Zen, this is not a radically new idea. The Zen arts, there's Kinyan, the walking meditation, there's Zen martial arts, Zen flower arranging, the tea ceremony. These are meditations in action, being totally attentive, attention-focused. Instead of on a mantra or an image or breathing, they focus it on the doing. So that's all I meant, you know, or Socrates meant by meditating in action.
The title of your book, No Ordinary Moments, you have a good example of what No Ordinary Moments means, and I think that would be a good one for our listeners.
this is just wonderful. You're like channeling me, I'll tell you, because this is exactly what I wanted to say next.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
great.
Well, we didn't rehearse this, folks.
No,
really
we didn't.
Actually, I should provide a context, okay? I've written 12 books, and anybody can drop by peacefulwarrior.com if they want to see a movie trailer or click on books and see all the books I've done. Each one is very different, as you've seen, having seen a couple of them. They have very different content and purpose. I don't just write the same book in six different covers.
You don't?
No, I hope that's refreshing. After I wrote Way of the Peaceful Warrior and another book called Sacred Journey of the Peaceful Warrior, which were fictional, kind of narrative, semi-fictional, based on autobiographical material, after I wrote those two, people said, well, I was inspired. I love your story, Dan, but how do you actually apply some of these ideas in everyday life? So that's when I wrote No Ordinary Moments, A Peaceful Warrior's Guide to Daily Life. I'd like to tell another story. This is not one in the book. Socrates and I are in the gym. He's watching me do some complicated dismount off the horizontal bar, and I did a full twisting double somersault or something and stuck the landing, which is a good thing to do in gymnastics.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, yes, I stuck the landing. Then I pulled off my sweatshirt, threw it into my workout bag, and we were walking down the hall afterward. And he turned to me and said, you know that last move you did? He said, it was really sloppy. And I went, what are you talking about, Soc? I said, it was the best dismount I did in like a week. And he said, I'm not talking about the dismount. I'm talking about the way you ripped off your sweatshirt and threw it into your workout bag. Once again, he was pointing out I was treating one moment as special, worthy of my full attention, and another, I was sloppy. That was another lesson about no ordinary moments. But he went on to say, he said, Dan, poets practice poetry. Musicians practice their music. Gymnasts practice their gymnastics. But he said, I practice everything. Actually, that's a line from the movie I was able to slip in at the last minute. The point being, there's a difference of just doing things day to day, and we tend to habituate and not pay much attention when we're signing a check or doing the dishes. But can you imagine when you practice everything, you're practicing doing the dishes, you're practicing walking, practicing doing your signature, and it's a different quality of attention and being. It's not a matter of some compulsive, never-ending self-improvement program. It's more, it makes life interesting because you're doing it with the idea of refining it. And you realize you never do the same thing twice. It can always be a little more refined, relaxed. And are you breathing? Are you relaxed? Are you moving with elegance? So it's a different way of approaching life. And it's part of what I call the Peaceful Warrior's way.
And not get lulled by familiarity, to just realize, as you say, that nothing is done the same or felt the same or seen the same, that it's always a new now.
And no ordinary moments.
And no ordinary moments.
After a seminar, somebody came up to me once and said, I feel so inspired. And I said, don't worry, it'll pass. Because that's the truth, you know?
It is true.
So that's why I don't really set out as a goal to inspire people, because that gives them limited value. They may feel good for a little while, but then what do they take away with them? Rather, I like to sow seeds. So I like to give as much real reminders that people can take away with them, rather than just saying, look at the world and wonder, because how many people do that moment to moment? It would be nice, and I certainly do, but I think it happens more naturally over time. Life is a series of moments, and some moments I'm more awake than others, and some moments I'm kinder than others, and some moments I'm more intelligent than others. I think if we just understand that, we can bring more enlightened, kind, aware moments into our lives.
Your book, Living on Purpose, is a question and answer format, an interesting way to set it up in terms of the information and the quotations that you're sharing, because it's the kind of thing I think any reader can relate to, because we all have questions. And one of them was about a son where a father was feeling some guilt about how the son was experiencing his life. Twice he referred to the idea that if the father offered some form of sacrifice, that somehow this would assuage the son. Do you want to speak a bit about the idea of sacrifice?
Yeah, that's been a particularly difficult one for me growing up. I was really individual and self-absorbed, pretty much. Maybe some people share that. It was certainly true in my case growing up. And I made a good gymnast because I could focus on myself, my progress, my body, my training, and all that. It was really difficult for me to let go of something I might prefer for someone else's needs. And it didn't bode well for my early relationships. It was like I was the star of my movie and everyone else in the world was a bit player.
Yeah.
Maybe it's no worse than having the opposite be true for many people. They're bit players in the movie of their life, and everybody else is the director and producer. That's not balanced either. I had to address this issue of when can you just give up something? This particular question, this father, he was away from his son. His son was angry and frustrated, and I said, you can write him nice letters and tell him you love him, and words are very nice, but by actually going out of your way, taking off time at work and going to visit him, that will mean more to him, because kids are not dumb. That's more real to him, that you're giving up something rather than just saying a lot of nice words. And in terms of the idea of asking questions, you know, rather than just laying 24 principles on people, I mean, that's like overwhelming. It's like telling somebody 20 jokes in a row.
Yeah, right.
Can't remember any of them.
Yeah.
I thought one at a time. These were real questions people asked me. So it started out, you know, is there a larger purpose for living? And the answer to that was the first house rule. Earth is a school. Daily life is our classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, I explain that. Then I use as examples of those principles, applications, actual questions people wrote to me over time. The second question in the book, which is, I'm reading it only because I get this a lot, where can I find the right teacher for me? Because many people have, you know, they're so envious. They say, boy, you had a teacher like Socrates, and I wish I had a Socrates. Well, they don't get that. I want to share my teachers with others. That's why I wrote the book, so he could become their teacher too. But in the answer to that question is the house rule, our teachers appear in many forms. You know that old saying, when the student is ready, the teacher appears?
Mm-hmm.
Many people misunderstand that and think when they're somehow deserving or prepared enough, some teacher will just appear in their life to lead them or kick them up the path.
With a sign on their chest.
Oh, yeah. Here, I'm your teacher. Really, the point is, when someone is ready, the teacher appears everywhere. To explain this, I just say master teachers are found not only on lonely mountaintops or in ashrams of the East. Our teachers may take the form of friends or adversaries, of clouds, animals, wind, water. Moment to moment, our teachers reveal all we need to know. The question is, are we paying attention?
You mentioned mistakes a few times, but I don't think that you would consider anything a mistake either, would you, Dan?
I love your questions. I have to tell you. First of all, we live in two worlds. One world we live in is the conventional world, conventional mind, taking out the trash, going to work, and doing whatever we do in everyday life. The other world, which many people yearn for, even those who are very successful materially and so on, is the transcendent. And that has a different set of rules. So when we say there are no accidents, conventionally speaking, there are absolutely accidents. Every one of us has spilled milk or water or tripped into something or bumped our toe when we weren't paying attention. But from a transcendental perspective, then we could say that all things serve, everything has a purpose, and there are no accidents or coincidences. It's all part of this flow of life. There are only lessons. When I say there are no accidents, I'm speaking from a transcendental view. Many people don't realize that, because other people could say, come on, I had an accident the other day, and they can argue. But there's no need to argue, because they're both true on different levels.
Success involves doing common things of life uncommonly well.
In one of my books, The Laws of Spirit, I talk about the law of process. Obviously, you don't need a process if you have no goals. Lily Tomlin once said, I always wanted to be somebody. Maybe I should have been more specific. If we do have goals, if there are specific goals we have, then between us and our goals is not usually a red carpet. More often than not, it's a swamp. And so the ways to get through that swamp is defined by success. And the reason I went off on that brief tangent is because many people define success as the top of the mountain, and therefore every step they take is a failure, because by definition they haven't reached the top of the mountain yet.
Mm-hmm.
And they have one big success they're waiting for. Well, I suggest we redefine success in terms of life being a series of moments, one of the other house rules in living on purpose. That is, every step in the right direction, if we define as a little success, we can pat ourselves on the back every day, every moment. Hey, I just made a little success here. And to enjoy the in-between.
Acknowledgement is so important, because otherwise we can just drift along, not really even taking note of where we've been, and not in a way to indulge ourselves, but to really just check the milestones as we're moving along through it all.
I once rode my bicycle from San Francisco area down to Los Angeles, which is about, I guess, 800 kilometers. If my goal was Los Angeles, it's the same kind of thing.
Sure.
I needed to define sometimes every pedal, or at least every kilometer, as success. Wow, I just went another kilometer. I just went another 100 meters. rather than, oh man, I don't feel like I'm going anywhere. It's all day. You know, have I made any progress in this bicycle? And that's what we do often in life. There are these wonderful teaching lessons. I remember years ago I was walking through the gymnasium when I was coaching at Stanford, and one of my top gymnasts on the team was lying on the floor. I came into the gym, and he was lying there stretching, pulling his leg toward his chest, and he was grunting and going, oh, God, this hurts. He said, this hurts so bad. Oh, I hate stretching. And I looked at him, and I thought I'd stumbled into a Mel Brooks movie. I was like, well, who's doing it to you? And often we live that way.
Well, it's like that story in your book where the guy is complaining about the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. That is so funny.
Shall I tell the story?
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, this is a little lesson about responsibility and choices we make. And and basically, I was complaining to Socrates about something, like a professor was being too hard on me. I was playing victim, which we often do, and a little in self-pity there. And he said, you know, you remind me of a construction worker I knew in the Midwest. Every day he'd open a sandwich and go, oh, I can't believe it. Another peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I hate peanut butter and jelly. And the next day the guy said the same thing. peanut butter and jelly again? Well, this went on and on until one of his workmates said, Mac, if you hate peanut butter and jelly, why don't you ask your wife to make you something different? And he said, my wife? He said, come on, you know I'm not married. He said, I make my own sandwiches. A good little lesson for us all, a good reminder.
Yeah, definitely. Initially, the book had only modest sales before Hal Kramer reportedly came out of retirement to republish the book and help make it a bestseller. Is that so?
That quote refers to Way of the Peaceful
Warrior.
I was
wondering if it must. Yeah, that was originally published, what, 1980 or something?
It was originally published hardback 1980. It had a subtitle of, it was a basically true story. My editor thought that was cute, but the bookstores were not amused because they didn't know where to put it. So it just died. It didn't get in any stores, and it was only about 3.5, 4 years later. I had a kind of a short life as a writer, I thought, and then this gentleman named Hal Kramer, who was a retired publisher, about 72 years old, got a hold of a copy and said, I love this book. He said, I'm going back into publishing. I'm starting with this book.
Oh, wow.
And then the word of mouth started. Of course, now Peaceful Warrior is out in 22 languages and been read by a number of millions of people around the world, and then the movie. And who would have guessed, you know?
Well, who would have guessed? Just speaking to anyone at any time of their life, if you're feeling discouraged or thinking that nothing is going to work out for you, stick around, because sometimes things take quite a while to unfold, and it is so worth staying around. I mean, I'm almost 50, and if I'd checked out in my teens, like a lot of teens consider, I wouldn't be here now, and
absolutely.
I'm loving where I am now.
Absolutely, and you know, if somebody who's really depressed, they think, oh, it's always going to be this way, but if they can just have a thread of attention for the possibility and know other people have hit the dark night of the soul, your past doesn't have to become your future. People just have no idea what is possible, how things can turn around. Sometimes it's in the stars. Sometimes we go through long periods where it's like walking through molasses and just this dark night of the soul. And then you emerge, though. When you come out of it, it's like you gain such strength and resources and compassion for having gone through that. Yeah, life can certainly turn around. One of my books is called The Life You Were Born to Live, which, again, lends a lot of self-understanding in terms of one of the central purposes we're here to work out in life. Soma Morita, a Japanese psychiatrist, had a wonderful saying. He said, when running up a hill, it's okay to give up as many times as you want, as long as your feet keep moving. Stress happens in our lives when the mind resists what is. Byron Katie, another teacher, once said, if you're going to resist what happens in life, you might as well try to teach a cat to bark. Because life's going to unfold as it will. In fact, it's been called the first law of spirit, the law of acceptance, or the law of surrender. It's one of the laws in one of my little books called The Laws of Spirit. People misunderstand surrender to mean capitulating to someone else's ego or giving up in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
It actually is one of the most assertive, creative, realistic, and intelligent responses we can make to any moment. Like the martial artist who uses someone else's force to throw them. You take what is given and make it over your way. That's not my words, that's Robert Frost, the poet.
Okay. The peaceful warrior is not invulnerable. I love that point.
Right.
It's the vulnerability to an open heart, to the world, to life, and to feeling that presence within you, which, you know, your teacher is not someone named Socrates outside of you, right? It's that presence within, and that's, I think, was a big part of that teaching in the Way of the Peaceful Warrior.
Absolutely, and Socrates emphasized that. It's not about putting all your power and trust in someone else. And yet it's not ignoring that either. There are three approaches to life, spiritual life or any kind of life. Mm-hmm. One is a childlike approach. Now, children need parents, someone to guide them and tell them what to do. And many people seek a teacher, a guide, a guru to guide their life and tell them what to do. And that mm-hmm. is nothing wrong with that any more than there's anything wrong with childhood. It is a phase of our spiritual growth. Many of us then go into the adolescent phase. Young people are often into this phase, and that phase is nobody else can tell me anything of value about my life. They're all fakes. They don't know anything. You know, only I know. And that's one phase, which is actually a more advanced. It's a transition point. And eventually we hit maturity where we say, we'll take wisdom where it's given, but we always check it out against our inner knower. We trust our intuition ultimately. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to learn tennis, nothing wrong with having a tennis coach.
Well, no. It's okay to ask questions. We don't learn something in an instant. In fact, if we did, where would be the satisfaction?
I have to tell you, when I was in high school, I was in a class of pretty smart kids. I wasn't that great at chemistry, but some of my friends were. They used to ask questions all the time. They were so interested. Well, what about this? What about that valence? And how come it happens this way? And why does it spin this way? And Mr. Solars, he was an old German, very, you know, kind of strict teacher.
Mm-hmm.
He finally got so frustrated, all these questions. He said, how would you ever learn if you keep asking questions? I love that because, yeah you got to ask questions.
Well, yeah.
Of yourself as well. That's how I wrote many of my books, just asking little questions and saying, let's see what comes up.
And maybe part of it is when you're younger, you feel like you want to know more than you do. And you think that if you ask a question, you'll show yourself up for being ignorant or a fool.
Socrates claimed, he said, the ancient Greek Socrates, he claimed to be the most ignorant of men, and all he did was ask questions. He would just say, I don't know anything, but maybe you can tell me, and he'd ask these wonderful, piercing questions. That's where the Socratic dialogue and the Socratic mm-hmm. method came from, which they use in law school as well.
Some of the book is sort of hard to read in terms of how frustrating it is for Dan, the subject in the book with Socrates, because he just keeps getting it wrong, and he keeps feeling like he's got it, and then he doesn't. And how true to life do you think that is?
I think it can take us up to 10 years to really embody what we've learned. Many people think just when they hear something that they're supposed to then just mm-hmm. totally embody. I think we need to be gentle with ourselves.
Yes.
There's a process of adaptation. I was coaching a young diver at Oberlin. I call it the Margaret effect. Because what she did is she'd try a new dive she'd never done before,
uh-huh.
and she'd go splat in the water. And she'd come out and say, Coach, I don't know what I did wrong. What did I do? And I'd have to explain it to her based on what I saw.
Right.
Well, after a while, she'd go splat again, but she'd say, I did it this, didn't I, Coach? She'd know what she did after she went splat.
Hmm.
And then, after a while she was doing the dive, she'd still blow it, but she'd see it while it was happening. And pretty soon, she could anticipate it beforehand, correct for it, and do the dive properly. So I think it's a process that we all go through. One of the greatest challenges in life, whether we call it personal growth or spiritual life, or just basically everyday life, is turning what we know into what we actually do.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I do offer very practical guidelines for that in my various books. One of them is called Everyday Enlightenment, the 12 Gateways to Personal Growth, which redefines the meaning of success in terms of these 12 gateways we all have to go through. But for now, let me just say, I recommend that people dream big, but start small and then connect the dots.
Step by step, in the now, in the here.
Well, yeah, these are good things to remember, you know, just like what's in front of us. Handle that rather than try to change the past or future, which isn't going to happen. We can change our future by changing what we do now.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we can change the past by paying attention to what we do now, because what we do now will soon become our past.
Well, exactly. And a lot of our past may feel frozen in time because others were aware of it, but a lot of our past is our own impressions in our mind. And if we change our minds, we can, I believe, change our past.
We can certainly view it differently.
We can view it differently.
Help resolve it.
What a great time it's been talking with you, Dan.
Oh, a pleasure here too, Lynn. And again, if anyone wants to be in touch, they can just go to peacefulwarrior.com, and my e-list and all that other information is there.
When you were a child, did you have any idea you'd be here now?
Well, good way to phrase it. actually, my life's been pretty much a mystery. This has been an interesting wave recently, but I'm riding it with as much grace as I can until it decides, you know.
Well, blessings to you, Dan.
Oh, same to you, Lynn.